Hello, and welcome to the Business of IT series from Blueprint. On today's podcast, we will be speaking with Ellen Gottesdiener. Thank you for listening, and enjoy.
We're very fortunate today to have Ellen Gottesdiener with us today. Ellen's a well-known industry expert, prolific author, sought-after speaker. She spends most of her time working directly with clients, helping to transform teams to agile and lean approaches to improve their working situation and, of course, to increase the value of what they deliver to the business as a whole. Welcome, Ellen.
Thanks for having me.
First question, in an industry that's going agile without question, how do we reconcile the roles of business analyst, product manager, product owner?
Yes, this is a big topic, and actually, to step back from the word role, the perspective that I like to have is that it's more about the goal. So we've written about this before, that it's the goal, not the role. What we need to have on teams are the disciplines of business analysis, the discipline of product management, and disciplines of project management, and also testing discipline, user experience discipline. So rather than trying to fight your way into the agile teams by saying, well, my role is this, my role is the analyst, you know, my role is the product owner. Yes, those roles take on certain disciplines, but what's important is that we have people on the team that can use those disciplines. So I can recall a team that I work with that there was no business analyst on the team. They had software engineers and testers, and they had a product champion, we prefer that term over product owner, and this was in a scientific application. They just didn't have this idea of a business analyst. However, one of the software engineers was really great with analysis. He had some really good modeling skills. He was doing the work of business analysis on that team. So I was doing some deeper coaching with him on agile analysis, and he was playing a really key role for the team in being able to drive out the requirements. So here you have a team that has no formal role. A software engineer is playing that role. We've worked with other teams where testers often have some really sharp analysis skills. Many testers want to build some of their modeling skills so that they can do better analysis. Right. And it's a really conundrum when you come to that PO or product owner role, because unfortunately the way people think of a product owner is they are superwoman or superman. Mm-hmm. They need to be feeding the team day to day, so they're deciding what to build and when to build it, and answering questions about, okay, which rule? Does this look right? Would you want the prototype to look like this? Meanwhile, so they're, you know, focused inward tactically, but meanwhile, excuse me, but we have a product, and we need to do research out in the field with customers, and we need to do competitive analysis, and we need to do some valuation. Where should we be as an industry? What we need to be sharply looking at trends and technology and market. Right. And to do both of those things, one person, it's virtually impossible. So a pattern, in particularly in large enterprises that we see, is that we need to have people that have product management skills, those more strategic outward looking skills and activities and disciplines. And at the same time, sort of tied at the hip, we need to have people that can work with the team to feed answers about the data and the rules. And yes, we're going to go Android versus iOS first from the environment or whatever. That's just an example. But that tactical sort of product owner is tied at the hip with the product manager who's looking out strategically. So even in the product owner quote role, there's a lot of confusion, and those people have, you know, really can struggle. And then you get into the project management. So one of our clients that I've been working with, we have a large group of product owners. That's what they're called. They're in a product and user experience group. And they're doing a little bit of project management, product ownership, product management all at the same time, and they're totally stressed in their time, and you can't do all of that work, they need help with some of those disciplines.
Right. So we have the disciplines, but the notion of role or predefined role or fixed role is kind of those barriers broken down.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if we're going to say, oh, I'm an analyst, so I'm not going to do testing, that's not good for the team. Yeah. I mean, we're all about the end game. Let's get to the deliverables.
Right.
Let's pitch in together. The best Agile teams learn to do that anyway.
Okay.
But getting hung up on the role, I'd like to change the conversation from role-based to more discipline. And do we have on our team the disciplines that we need to discover and deliver the high-value product
together,
that we need?
We need the pool of skills, basically, is what we should be looking at and not be focusing, as I said, on the traditional role titles, for example.
Yeah, there's an idea that the folks in the design thinking world have talked about called T people. I don't know if you've heard of that. But if you look at a capital T, you have a band on the top that goes horizontal wide.
Okay.
And then you have a slice that goes down that makes the stem of the T.
Okay.
So let's say we need people who have strong analysis skills. That's the vertical bar, but they have a broad understanding of, product management, I have an understanding of testing, I understand what the devs, the engineers are doing, so they can communicate to each other, pitch in if needed.
Mm-hmm.
And so almost if you think of it mentally, a whole bunch of T people, they may have deep skills in one or two areas. You have enough of those on the team, you have a sort of a square team.
You got the coverage you need. Excellent concept.
Yeah.
What are the problems that you're seeing that Agile teams have with, quote, requirements? So the traditional requirements word, which is a loaded term itself.
It is a loaded term. You know, sometimes I say there ain't no stinking requirements. Because they're really options, they're wants. So we talk about in Discover to Deliver three planning horizons.
Yeah.
The big view, the preview, and the now view.
Right.
And if you recast that word requirements,
yeah.
the big view are really things that you want. Those are, the big view would be things that would be a couple years out, 18 months, a couple of years, that would be traditionally on a product roadmap.
Yeah.
So that's what we think we want, really big chunky features, if you will. The preview would be a release level. And again, your mileage varies there, but let's say it's a month or 2 months out at a release. Now those are things that you know you need to deliver. So we went from wants to needs,
Oh, so time frame is kind of dictating this.
Yes, because in Agile we're smart and we're trying to get feedback and we learn from our deliveries, we validate, we're on the right track. So it's not until you're at the now view, whether you're using a time-boxed approach like Scrum and you have an iteration or a sprint concept, or whether you're using a flow-based model like Kanban where you're thinking about WIP and you're pulling an item in, now I need to make that a requirement. That is completely unambiguous. I know exactly what the expected results are, the acceptance criteria. So we're sort of spinning down the level of granularity from want to need to requirement, based on planning horizon.
Which is tied to time.
Yeah. And having gotten feedback. So everybody talks about these backlogs. And in Agile, we have backlogs that could have different things in them. Most of the time, teams think, that's where you put your stories. And yeah, you would have stories.
Right.
You would have potentially defects and other work that the team needs to get done for delivering the product.
Right.
But we need to have lumpy backlogs.
Right.
We don't want to have a whole bunch of thin sliced stories. You don't want to go through that slicing work until you really have decided, the product champion has decided, we need to pull this work in and deliver this for value reasons.
We've
looked at value and risk and about how much time it's going to take you to build it, right? So some things in the backlog can be big and chunky. Some things will be thin sliced because we're just about to deliver it.
Right.
So the backlog, that helps the backlog stay lean. And so they don't really become requirements till they're at the now view. So we like to think about the backlog being a set of unvalidated options.
Right.
requirements are not really, I'll go back to using that term because it's so common in our vernacular, but backlogs are a set of unvalidated options. And we need to try to make the smartest choice possible at a given point in time and what we're going to pull, deliver it, and get some feedback as quickly as we can.
Right. And
does
driving,
that make sense?
And progressively driving to greater levels of detail as our time horizon kind of shrinks in front of us.
Right. And so that's a big shift.
Yeah.
As you ask what some of the problems are. So a lot of teams are so used to writing textual requirements and trying to go down to the glory of detail and a lot of documentation and making that shift of, I don't have to know everything up front.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's something really beautiful here.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a tension that's really cool. And on one hand, when you think about agile requirements, you're thinking, I have to have this tolerance for ambiguity because I'm not exactly sure what I'm going to be building in the next release or next month. I might have an idea, but I don't have to know exactly. So our minds have to have that tolerance for ambiguity, but you need to have a drive for concrete specificity when it's time to deliver. So your mind, and this is the thing I love about this work, because your mind is balancing tolerance for ambiguity with a drive for specificity at the same time. Yeah.
Right.
So you know that's a
depending on what you're focusing on at that point or what you're looking at.
I think it was F. Scott Fitzgerald has a great quote. I'm gonna probably mess up the quote, but it's something like this: the indication of a great mind is one that can hold two conflicting ideas in it at the same time.
Well, this sounds like it.
It does. So it's a mental challenge. And a difficult one for a lot of teams.
But I could also see how you could err in either direction. Like, you don't go to that degree of specificity at the correct time. And at the other end, we still have a whole lot of people that are really uncomfortable not having that detail, even though it's way too early to do so.
Yes.
And they're, in many cases, a huge force that are still driving people to go to that level of detail.
And I mean, in
kind of
some
at their
way,
peril.
That's exactly right. I mean, user stories are great, and I love user stories as a way to, as you know, Ron Jeffries has said, it's a promise for a conversation.
Yes.
But the thing is that one of the patterns that we've seen agile teams do with stories is they think, okay, well, I have our stories, and I have a bulleted list of acceptance criteria. I'm ready. Well, that's not necessarily true, unless the team, the testers, the devs.
Mm-hmm.
Have really very specific domain knowledge, they may not know what business rule they have to implement. They may not know what data, or even the environment of use. They may not know the quality attributes like the performance level and the security.
Yeah.
So we need to be able to drive down to that level of specificity at the now view.
Right.
So people think, okay, I have a user story. That's really cool. As a user, I need to do something. Well, one of the issues with that is, and Tony, you're familiar with the 7 product dimensions that we talk about in Discover and Deliver. The user story is really only discussing 2 of those dimensions, the user and the action.
Mm-hmm.
So when teams just work off of stories and don't deepen their conversations around all of those dimensions that make up holistically requirements, then they run into trouble inside their iterations. Then they have the phenomenon of the traveling stories.
Yes.
That's so
it's kind of
ubiquitous.
Another version of churn.
Yes,
basically
exactly.
We keep revisiting sprint after sprint, and in good old traditional waterfall, it was the whole rework.
Right, and the teams end up having that rework,
and
realizing, we didn't slice those stories well enough because we didn't understand drive down into the story itself holistically, and that wreaks all kinds of havoc.
Wow. So there is that sweet spot where you described when we have those horizons correct. And we go to the level of detail that kind of matches the horizon. You kind of find that sweet spot and we get our maximum velocity, if you will.
Yeah.
but you could overshoot either way.
Right. And and one other thing that they sometimes, the teams that we work with sometimes forget to do is, okay, well, let's just talk about some examples. More and more and more people are catching on this idea of specification by example, behavior-driven development, acceptance test-driven development. There's different names for this, but let's talk about a real example. And here, of course, our business partners, product champions, subject matter experts can just spew real examples. So we often will have workshops that are, you know, they could be release planning, product road mapping, or even at an iteration level. And we will have our business partners at the wall writing out examples. Okay, and it might be examples of, you know, of assay data.
Okay.
So that we really understand the rules. It's a way to reverse engineer to the rules. Or they may be drawing without even calling it a model such as a state diagram.
Right.
And the transitions. And then we can focus on, okay, which states are we focusing on for this particular iteration or release? And we can have the deeper conversations.
So using those as a catalyst, really.
Exactly.
To come into the conversation from different angles.
Exactly. Huh. So we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. For those listeners that have analysis skills, those models are beautiful. And they're really, really helpful for deepening the conversation.
Yes. Excellent. Shift gears a little bit. The focus on delivery has certainly shifted to delivering business value versus years ago. I remember when all headlights and attention was on delivering software, and once that was done, we felt our job was over. How do you integrate this focus on value into your work with Agile teams as you consult with them?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I mean, it makes things difficult a lot of times, because people use this term value. It's almost a mantra in Agile, but people don't explain what do they mean by value.
Yeah.
So there actually is a value standard body of knowledge.
Oh.
And in that body of knowledge, value is defined roughly to say the translation, it's fair return for goods, services, or money, of goods, services, or money for something exchanged.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not always about money.
Right.
You may be giving me a benefit that improves my life or makes me happy or lets me save time that I'm willing to pay for. Right. So we first have to have that definition of value clear. And then we talk about this in Discover Deliver, we want to recast stakeholders from just generic stakeholders into thinking about partners.
Right.
And the partners are from the customer, business, and technology realms.
Okay.
And they each have their own view of value, you see. So as we like to say, value is in the eyes of the beholder. If we always try to deliver, say, a user's value, it might not be financially viable to the business. If we only try to do what the technology partners want, because they think it's feasible, it may not be viable from a business point of view. So you get the idea, is that you want to balance the three perspectives. So when we're working with teams, what we do is say, okay, let's look at those three partners. Who are those partners? And what is their definition of value? What are their value considerations?
Right.
And then we turn to the product champion and say, for this next time horizon that we're focused on, which of these value considerations trump?
Right.
Right. So I remember working with a team once in release planning, and they were discussing value considerations, and one of the options in building in a particular platform, this happened to be a cloud platform, with a cloud database that had a lot of value for the lead architect, the global architect. He wants to really be able to use this product as a way to test the viability of cloud data storage and save a lot of money. So there were some operational expenses there. But from the product champion point of view, the data that we were working on was protected under what's called in the U.S. HIPAA laws.
Yeah.
In other words, highly regulated. And that data storage platform had not been addressed security. And that quality attribute of security definitely trumped the savings, right?
Yeah.
So those conversations, the beauty is, if we think about the three partners, have them together discuss their value considerations, and then turn to the product champion who has the ultimate burden and responsibility to make the choice,
right,
which value do we focus on, then we've at least had this understanding,
right,
and it happens very, very quickly.
Okay.
In conversation, we literally put this stuff up on the wall.
Right.
Because, you know, value, as I said, value is not always about money. It's, you know, you do sometimes definitely want to increase revenue.
Right.
But sometimes you'll do things to avoid costs,
yeah,
or protect revenue, avoiding costs like having a regulatory violation, or improving customer service so people, you increase the, quote, lifetime value of your customers.
Right.
So those are some patterns that fall into, we call it a RASCUS, increased revenue, avoid cost, improve service.
Right.
But it's not always about money. There may be things that we'll do for our users that have a value that's not tangible, that's difficult.
Yeah.
There's always a way to translate things into money, but it's sometimes more difficult,
yes,
to translate it into money.
I'm trying to, as you talk about this, I can't help but think on the time scale and how those values may shift and change and morph over time. So it's not like at the outset of the project we sit down and make this decision. I imagine it's on a more frequent basis.
Absolutely.
Maybe down to a sprint. I don't know what level.
Depends
on the
market.
Situation or the,
yes,
market you're
depending
in.
On the market segment. That's a really great point, because value is not only in the eyes of the beholder,
mm-hmm,
but value constantly changes.
Right.
The market conditions change. Our competitor comes out with something,
yep,
that threatens our customer segment or our geography. So we always have to have our eyes on that prize, and that prize shifts around.
Yeah. Right.
So just being really explicit about what is value, and in those short conversations, having everybody rallying around that is so powerful.
Yeah. And then being able to track it.
And then you can track
stay on
it,
top of it.
But you're always,
and
shifts, you're always using, when you're pulling an item from the backlog, and
okay,
you're doing what we call optioning in the structured conversation, where you look at an item and you say, okay, what are the possibilities for what we would deliver with, say, this story, looking at the user, the data, the action, the environment, the quality attributes, and the interface, those seven dimensions. How do we decide which ones? If we have,
mm-hmm,
you know, five sets of data, for example, or choice of which rules for this next release, the mechanism to slice is value.
Right.
Which are the ones that are going to give us the highest value?
It's really the driving force.
Right.
Yeah. Would another one be risk? I mean,
oh,
general
balancing.
Principle of I want to do risky first.
Absolutely. Yeah. Balancing risk.
Right.
You look at value. You look at, obviously, benefits. You look at risk. And another little sneaky thing called dependencies.
Remember those
dependencies. And dependencies have an interesting play in Agile requirements. And this is a little bit of a trap for Agile teams, too, because there's sort of two types of dependencies. There's dependencies on external partners. Maybe somebody's giving you a software component, or another team is building a service that you're going to consume. But that's sort of external dependencies. But then we come to dependencies in the requirements,
okay,
and it comes down to the data, where I can't build some capability or deliver some capability unless I have data in a specific state, or correct data in a specific state.
Right.
So we also have to have some good discipline, analysis discipline, to understand those dependencies.
Right. So how good your process is, or how good you are at executing, really depends on how good you do everything you just described.
Yeah, it certainly makes a big difference.
On an ongoing basis.
Definitely. Yeah.
When I speak with people in large IT shops about their processes, I often hear back terms or vernacular, hybrid, scrummerfall, wagile, countless other terms that seems never ending. And most times that I'm observing, I may be wrong, but most times I see that it's a company that's somewhere on this journey or somewhere on the road from traditional waterfall because the company's been around for a while, and they're on this journey going towards Agile, and they're somewhere along there in that evolution. And each one seems to have some degree of homegrown, handcrafted solution. No two seem to be the same. If we fast forward, say, 5-10 years from now, what do you think this picture is going to look like? Will it have converged? Are we still diverging? Interested in your prediction.
Well, I left my crystal ball at home, Tony, so I'm not sure I'm going to be able to
and then
be
I
very
have a question
specific
on the stock market after that.
Yeah, right, I wish. I think that we'll always be, in a healthy way, always be adapting practices that seem to be working. What I think will be maybe true in 5 years is that larger enterprises that are harder to make changes to mm-hmm. will start to understand the value of feedback uh-huh. and that whole that other Agile mantra of inspect and adapt. That mm-hmm. we want to do experiments and get some feedback and learn from that. And it really is true that different, you know, we work with a lot of different organizations and they all have different cultures, different ways of being, different, you know, smells and not people smells, but, you know, organizational, not necessarily bad smells either. They could be very nicely scented and there's a really powerful, good energy in an organization.
Right.
So there'll always be the need for people to adapt for their
right.
environment.
Right.
You know, people talk about best practices. I really hate that term,
right.
actually, because there's no best practices. There's just good practices in your context.
Mm-hmm.
Context matters.
Right.
So when people say they're using hybrid, the next, you know, the next and is that going to change in the future? Probably not, mm-hmm. but the question is it working?
Right.
Is it giving you the outcomes that you want? If it's giving the outcomes or it's all the organization is culturally ready to take on at a given point in time,
right.
then it's fine.
Right.
So I think we'll always be doing this merging of practices.
Which I guess is a good thing, not a bad thing.
Yeah, I mean, it, when people get like zealots over, oh, thou must do mm-hmm. XP, thou must do Kanban, thou must do DSDM, that's not healthy.
Right.
And it's also not a very good change pattern either.
Yeah. So what got you into this field and what keeps you in it?
That keeps me in it. That part is a little bit easier. actually sort of by accident, to tell you the truth, because my background was a dual major in psychology and sociology. And I really fell into a training program to be a developer, and went through a very comprehensive program, and ended up working in financial services as a programmer analyst. Then moved up to a project manager. Did a stint in training for a little while, and one of the things that we had going in our training program, which is a little side story, that was unconsciously competent because I would act as a customer, give the students a case, you know,
right.
you need to deliver this change, and then we would come in for a session. We used to call it roast the instructor, but we were really role playing the business customer.
Okay.
And they would have to ask questions, and when I ended up the person that was running the program had to leave, so they said, Ellen, will you manage this whole entry-level training program? I said, okay, you know. We had a pattern of, we had 9 case studies that they would go through, and there was a predictable bell curve
uh-huh.
for how long it would take the students to complete each case
okay.
before they could move to, we'd add more skills, deepen the case study, and so forth. I said, I just want to make one little change. I'm going to have them, after they interview us, and they did a group interview because we had a group of students, their first deliverable is not going to be code. Their first deliverable must be a list of test conditions. And then we would sign off. I would pair with another instructor. We would review and sign those off. And then I said, your next deliverable is your actual test data. I mean, date, byte by byte. and every piece of data that you would use to test. Then you could do your design, then you could do your code, then you run your test. Well, what happened was I created a beautiful nightmare, because the beauty was they were all getting done with the case studies days earlier because of that change. The problem for me was because we had a 6-month schedule and our business areas weren't ready and the technical areas they weren't ready to consume these trainees. So but the thing is I ran accidentally was doing acceptance test driven development without realizing it, that people thinking about their tests first made a completely different big difference. Their code was much cleaner. They were testing, their testing was not like this giant nightmare.
I guess they have a much more firm target to shoot at.
Absolutely.
Basically is what we're getting down to.
Absolutely. And when they didn't understand, when they didn't have the right conditions, they would start to deepen the questions to us as the role-playing the business people. So I thought this was really cool, even though, I had that little scheduling problem. And I really loved that part of it. And went back, as a project lead, was trying to institute some of those practices inadvertently doing, I guess, many years ago, ATDD. But the thing that keeps me in this work is that is the people, is the working with people and the change. And, my first book is Requirements by Collaboration. Mm-hmm. And having people collaborate together around shared goals, defining them first, and seeing how much commonality they actually have, and that every single person has their own story and knowledge to lend to the success of the product, that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
That's what keeps me in it.
So trying to get the barriers down and basically be able to leverage all of that.
Right, right. It's the collaboration that does it for me.
Just a few questions in closing, if I could. What's one piece of advice you'd have for somebody who's about to undertake a new large enterprise project, independent of role or discipline, excuse me?
Right. A new enterprise project. One piece of advice?
Yeah. Like maybe imagine somebody who hasn't really been in that situation before. They're walking down the hallway to enter this. What's a piece of advice you can give them?
I would say that you enter with a curious mind and understand those three partners, who those people are in the organization, customer, business, and technology, who those players are, what they value, and engage with all of them in an equal way, because then you'll really get the big picture much, much quicker.
Excellent. What shifts or trends do you see in IT, or the business of IT, the title of this session, over the next couple of years? I mean, there's so many out there, but are there any that'll, kind of bubble above the surface? Do you think that'll drive a lot of change, or that are fascinating?
Well, there's a lot of, obviously, technology is going to change constantly. So that's a given. So that's not going to change. Technology is going to change. I think one of the things, and I'm actually, this is part hope and part a little bit of noticing.
Okay.
I think one of the things that's going to start happening is people are going to stop thinking about applications and start thinking more about products. And then we'll be making the shift toward the discipline of product management, which is starting to take hold a little more so in Europe and growing here, that product management is indeed a discipline, and that these applications are products that have a lifetime value, that go through their own life cycle, that need care and feeding, and that we need to have people that are skilled in managing those products.
Right, right.
I think that's one thing that's going to start to happen. So now we, and by so doing, we're less IT versus business, and we're more, this is a product, and we're all collaborating around the success of this product.
Right.
Our product might happen to be very software intensive, or a system with lots of software embedded. Or even services, that is also a product.
Yeah.
So I think there will be a shift toward more of a product perspective.
Product mindset.
Yes.
What are your favorite websites? Where do you go to spend your time when you're not in there helping
my free
customers?
Time.
Websites, blogs for good advice?
Well, there's a couple that come to mind. I love David Kelly's Design Thinking blog. And I think more and more people are becoming aware of that. The world of user experience, experience design, and information architecture has really been popularized by his work and the work of IDEO. A lot of it isn't new, but it's very powerful. It's very human-centric. And I think more classic IT people would benefit by following that world. So I spend a little time on that one. I also follow a bunch of product management blogs. In particular, I think I'd highlight Marty Kagan's blog.
Okay.
And he's fairly well, he's sort of a rock star in the product management world. And there's a colleague I met in Germany last year at a conference I presented at, Karina Baldoff, who has a really cool blog, because I like the diversity of what she writes about, called Finding Marbles.
Huh.
It's just fun. She learns in her journey as a coach, as an agile coach, she writes about different things that she's learning.
Interesting.
And of course, to feed your brain and eyes and ears, you can't beat TED.
Right.
And I would say in TED, you know, don't just go to the technology ones. You go to the biology and anthropology and everything, because everything and everybody is connected.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you so much for spending time with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Tony.
Take care.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this interview, please be sure to share it through your social media networks.